Numerous other newspapers had joined the bandwagon in doing stories on Casey. Hopkinsville was literally deluged by reporters, as well as by the sick seeking cures and the merely curious. People camped out on the steps of Edgar's parents' house, waiting for Edgar to come home for a visit, as Leslie assured reporters that he would. A particularly brazen reporter even went inside the house and stole pictures that were later published in the New York Times. Edgar received a telegram from Ketchum the same day he was visited by the news reporter in Montgomery. The Hopkinsville physician didn't apologize for having revealed the intimate details of Casey's life to the press, but rather wanted Edgar to return to Hopkinsville and make a business of giving readings. Albert D. Noe, the manager and later owner of the Latham Hotel in Hopkinsville, had agreed to bankroll the partnership, and Leslie had expressed his desire to conduct the readings. All they wanted to know was what terms Edgar would accept for his services. Here, presented to Edgar, was public validation of his psychic gifts, as well as an offer to return home to his family. He had the most important decision of his life to make. There was one thing that Edgar had already made up his mind about. His psychic ability was not a trick, or an ailment, or the work of the devil. It was a talent, a gift that the Lord had provided him. And, as a gift from God, it had to be used. This, more than anything else, compelled him to go into partnership with Ketchum and Noe. The fact that Edgar knew that Gertrude would not approve of the partnership did not interfere with his decision. Edgar believed that in time, Gertrude would come to realize that the business of giving psychic readings had to be accorded the same degree of professionalism as his photography business. He needed an established location where truly sick people would know where to find him, a reliable stenographer to take the readings down, and a conductor whom he could trust. The next morning, Edgar wrote to Ketchum. He told him he would accept the proposition on the express condition that no one seeking trance counsel would be turned away because of financial hardship. The poor would be treated for free. In addition, Leslie would conduct all the readings. Half the income generated by the partnership was to go to Edgar and his father. The other half would go to Ketchum and Noe, who would pay the partnership's overhead expenses and, in addition, finance a photography studio in Hopkinsville that would be owned and operated by Edgar and his family. By return telegram, Noe and Ketchum agreed to Edgar's terms. Gertrude was pleased at the prospect of having Edgar back in Hopkinsville, but was distrustful of Ketchum and dubious of any business in which Leslie was a partner. Edgar's father had proven himself to be unreliable, and his willingness to trade off Edgar's name and growing reputation was a matter of serious concern. Edgar assured her that everything would be fine. He also volunteered to let the source itself make the ultimate decision if this partnership was a good idea or not. A reading on The Work was conducted on February 13, 1911. The overall thrust of the reading was positive. The message that came through was that the patients, or those who benefit from the readings, should supply the funds necessary for the survival of Edgar and his partners. In addition, the more credibility that the readings generated, and the more people who believed in the value of the information, the more Edgar and his partners would gain materially from it. But the most important aspect of this reading was the suggestion that the ultimate purpose of The Work was not to provide diagnostic insights to bring about miraculous cures, but to help people open their minds and accept the truth of the ethereal or spiritual world. It is no doubt for this reason that the source then offered an important clue to the future success or failure of the work. The reading ended with the statement, "The minute we gain credence and give credit to ourselves, we lose it all." Edgar, Leslie, Noe, and Ketchum chose to make their headquarters in a suite of rooms on the top floor of the Thompson Building at 702 East Main Street in downtown Hopkinsville. It was a large red brick building that was adjacent to the Hopper Brothers bookstore and one block from Ketchum's office. A long-running joke was that Edgar Casey had finally moved up in the world since leaving Hopper Bookstore. He had moved upstairs. A sign reading Casey Photo Studio was posted outside on the street, pointing the way up a short flight of stairs. In the hallway at the top, another sign marked the entrance to Edgar's three-room photo studio, which was outfitted with the most modern photographic equipment. A few yards further down the hall was a third sign, written in smaller letters. It read, Psychic Diagnostician, and the door beside it opened into a suite of offices that were connected through the back to the photo studio. It was in one of these rooms that Edgar gave the readings. Patients themselves were not normally invited into these offices and didn't get to meet Edgar Cayce personally. Rather, patients who desired to come to Hopkinsville and be examined by a physician, as opposed to those whose requests were handled through the mail, would meet with Ketchum at his office, where they could receive the treatments recommended in the readings. The concept of keeping Edgar physically removed from his patients was Ketchum's idea. This was not only for legal reasons, stemming from the fact that Edgar was not a licensed physician, nor was he capable in a conscious state of dispensing medical advice. It was also for purely practical reasons. Personal contact between Edgar and his patients was viewed as an unnecessary interference in Edgar's personal life, and to the business of conducting daily trance sessions. Due to the unique nature of their proposed partnership, and before their formal 5-year contract was signed, several prominent Hopkinsville judges, among them John T. Hanbury, were invited to witness a reading. They were to give their honest opinion as to whether or not laws would be broken by conducting the business Noe and Ketchum had in mind. These consultants were asked to give an opinion on the legality of selling information from such a source, and they responded that they knew of no law that prohibited it. In fact, Judge Hanbury, who had previously received his own readings when Edgar was living in Bowling Green, was so impressed by the demonstration that he later offered to purchase Cayce's contract from Noe and Ketchum. In addition to the attorneys, state medical authorities were asked for an opinion. They, too, witnessed a reading, and replied that nothing could prevent such a practice unless a special law were enacted against it. And since such a law would have to name Cayce specifically, and since this in itself was unconstitutional, it appeared that nothing whatever could be done to stop them. Having explored the legal ramifications of their partnership, Edgar, Leslie, Noe, and Ketchum went ahead and signed the contract. No legal document of its kind had ever before existed in Kentucky, or anywhere else for that matter. Edgar was, in the eyes of the law, a psychic diagnostician, and a highly paid one at that. Readings were begun in earnest the same day that the documents were signed, and before the first week had ended, 9 patients had received and paid for readings. Mrs. Gussie Ellington, a patient from Chicago, Illinois, who was dying of tuberculosis, received the first reading. 2 months later, when she requested and received a second reading, her physician reported that her condition had measurably improved. Mrs. Eleanor Sledge, who received the last reading of that first month, came to Ketchum complaining of migraine headaches, which had plagued her for years. Cayce, in trance, suggested that the problem was the result of a lesion that had grown on her spine, which could be removed through osteopathic manipulation. Her eventual cure, less than 2 months later, was considered nothing short of remarkable. In the first few months of the partnership, Ketchum became aware of the source as a distinct personality or being, with many human characteristics. These included, at times, poor grammar, and an almost childlike appreciation and wonder when visiting new places and examining new patients. However all-knowing the source might be, it could also be short or long-winded, disliked what it considered inane or sloppy questions, and had a highly developed sense of humor. Examples were numerous. Asked once about how a person should overcome worrying, the source simply said, "Quit worrying." A woman, wanting to know if wearing glasses, as Cayce had recommended, was really necessary, was told, "The body really needs glasses, else we wouldn't have said it." When a patient asked if a medication should be rubbed on the outside, he was simply told, "You can't rub it on the inside." Ketchum believed that because the source sounded so human, that it was none other than Cayce's subconscious mind tapping into a vast database of information. He believed that a heavenly presence didn't take over when Cayce went into trance, but rather, Cayce's spirit was free to communicate with other spirits when he lost consciousness. Although subsequent readings suggested that there was clearly much truth in this theory, Ketchum himself later admitted that whatever happened was far more complicated than Casey's spirit reaching out into the universe. This was, however, a good starting point. As would be demonstrated on numerous occasions in the future, Casey's higher self may have indeed retrieved information. But there were also many instances when a heavenly presence interceded or guided trance sessions, and would sometimes actually introduce itself to the conductor. Among these heavenly presences were the Archangel Michael and the Master of Masters, Jesus Christ himself. Ketchum also became certain that Casey's subconscious mind could travel to the physical location of the patient. There were so many references to the actual surroundings of the individual for whom he was doing the reading that no other explanation seemed possible. During one reading, Casey remarked on the color of a patient's pajamas. On another occasion, he appeared to pause on the way into another patient's house to mention that she had a particularly beautiful tree in her yard. As Ketchum realized, the process of commuting with another person's subconscious mind was not always easily accomplished. Casey, in trance, would sometimes come right out and say that this information wasn't to be shared. At other times, Casey seemed to be able to peer at will right inside a person without interference, which suggested that individuals themselves could block Casey's examination of their bodies. Ketchum felt sure that a patient's motivation was a key factor in the equation, both on a conscious and an unconscious level. The times when Ketchum got the best results from Casey was when a person genuinely wanted help for the reasons that they had stated, and when the person receiving the information had good intentions. A person saying one thing and thinking something different resulted in a miscommunication. Information that would hurt or harm someone would simply not be given. Like Ketchum, Edgar himself was slowly beginning to understand some of the dynamics involved in giving readings. He also began to take a keen interest in the medical side of the business. For the first time in his career, he made a conscious effort to study the completed trance discourses. He seemed to genuinely want to know how the treatments he recommended worked. However, he was a long way from understanding them. The source recommended a myriad of different kinds of treatments, which sometimes included the use of various electrical devices. Exactly how these devices were supposed to work was a mystery. Ketchum didn't know, nor did Edgar. But as Edgar and Ketchum soon realized, their challenge was not so much obtaining helpful information from the source as much as in finding doctors willing to apply the treatments. Edgar came to realize the extent of this problem when he began writing personal notes or letters for patients, which accompanied the readings. In the return mail, he would receive dozens of requests from patients asking the names of doctors who would conduct the treatments as outlined. The vast majority of patients weren't being treated because their doctors at home wouldn't conduct the treatment that had been prescribed. Some even talked their patients out of trying the treatment elsewhere, too. In Hopkinsville, it was more possible to get cooperation from the various doctors, but most of the patients that were coming to Edgar and Ketchum were from out of town. This realization was weighing heavily on Edgar's mind when he was visited by Frank Moore, a successful businessman whose 3.5-year-old niece was suffering from polio. Physicians didn't hold out much hope for her recovery. In trance, Casey diagnosed the illness and recommended treatments. The results were nothing short of phenomenal. Moore was impressed to the point that he offered to buy Casey's contract, or at the least, he would have the existing agreement expanded to include a hospital where an entire staff of doctors and nurses could be assembled, a staff who would become familiar with the specialized treatments recommended in the readings. This was, as far as can be determined, the first time there was any discussion of a hospital being built. Edgar loved the idea because it solved what he was beginning to view as the central problem of the work. In this hospital, treatments would be carried out exactly as the readings suggested. Initially, Noe and Ketchum also liked the idea. Their only concern was that they should be adequately compensated for the work they had done in developing and publicizing Edgar's abilities, and that they would share in any profits generated by a hospital. Toward this end, they discussed revising the original contract and extending it by an additional 5 years. Their general understanding, agreed to in principle in a meeting between Noe and Moore, stipulated that Noe and Ketchum would receive a share of all proceeds from the hospital. This was in addition to the terms previously agreed upon between themselves and the two Caseys. Moore would use his resources to build a hospital in Nortonville, Kentucky, along with an accompanying hotel to house visiting patients or their families. Based on their verbal understanding, Moore hired architects and began building the hospital. By the middle of 1912, land had been surveyed and cleared in Nortonville, and a team of laborers had poured the foundation. Problems arose almost immediately. Noe and Ketchum kept coming up with one reason after another for not signing the new contract. They had apparently decided to stall negotiations until a dollar value could be placed on the worth of their operation in Hopkinsville. Then, in the midst of the discussions that ensued, Moore was badly hurt in a mining accident. Edgar gave an emergency reading, which stated that Moore's spine had been seriously injured in the accident. If certain corrective measures were not taken, the spinal curvature would gradually produce uric acid poisoning, which would result in blindness. To Moore and his doctors, this sounded absurd. Ketchum, perhaps not wanting to look foolish to his peers, allegedly laughed along with Moore's doctors at the suggestion that a curvature of the spine could cause blindness. Moore didn't know who to trust, for it looked to him that even Ketchum didn't put much faith in the reading. Either that, or Ketchum was trying to manipulate the situation to drive a wedge between Moore and Casey. Two separate civil lawsuits resulted from the rift that grew between the prospective partners. Moore sued Ketchum and Noe to release Edgar from his contract, and Ketchum and Noe filed a countersuit claiming that Edgar's and Moore's written agreement was invalid because it breached the previous agreement they had with Edgar. The two cases were never heard in front of a judge because Moore returned to his home in Columbus, Ohio to recuperate. Construction on the hospital ceased. Its foundation disappeared under a growth of thick brush, and to this day, it stands as a mute reminder of what could have been. Edgar was visibly hurt by the lack of trust exhibited by his partners, and, for the first time, began to suspect that Ketchum hadn't been completely honest. The situation became all the more tense when Roswell Field, a reporter for Hearst's Chicago Examiner, appeared in the Casey studio. Field wanted to write a series of articles for the Hearst newspapers, and also discussed the possibilities of writing a book. Field's reports captured the attention of Hearst himself, who invited Edgar to visit Chicago as his guest. Edgar went in early March of 1911, along with his father, Leslie, and A.D. Noe. During the 10-day trip, three physicians were invited to examine Edgar and asked that he do a reading for them. One of these doctors, William Sadler, was reported to be none other than the physician who had previously assaulted Casey with the needle back in Bowling Green 5 years earlier. They insisted that Edgar try to locate a missing woman, and to unravel several other local mysteries that had been troubling them. At Edgar's behest, Leslie finally demanded that no readings of this kind be given, but that an actual patient needing assistance be used for the experiment. Early the next morning, the reporters finally agreed to conduct a reading for what has been presumed to be one of Dr. Sadler's patients. Immediately after the reading, one physician asked the other if the description that had been provided was a fair and accurate portrait of the patient. The second physician's reply was rather cryptic, neither saying the reading was correct or not. The third physician didn't wish to talk about the reading at all, but insisted that Casey go back into trance and attempt information for a member of his family who was ill. Casey did so, apparently to much success. But when the reporters asked the doctor to sign a statement, he absolutely refused. The next morning, bold headlines in the Chicago Examiner read, "He came, we saw, but he did not conquer." The accompanying article stated that Casey claimed to be able to do many things and refused to do them, and that the doctors had said there was nothing whatever in what was given. The article also said that the stenographers had failed to write anything at all, saying it was such gibberish that it was not understandable to anyone. The next afternoon's paper did print testimonials of people who claimed to have been helped by Casey, but the damage had already been done. Edgar naturally felt let down, and was fearful of the direction that their partnership had taken. Ketchum and Noe didn't seem to have the best interest of Edgar or their patients in mind. They were far more interested in promoting themselves and the partnership than they were in helping people. Just days after his return from Chicago, Edgar became a father for the second time. Gertrude gave birth to another son, Milton Porter, on March 28, 1911. Edgar was so preoccupied with Noe and Ketchum that he did not pay close enough attention to the situation at home. The baby was not receiving enough nourishment from his mother's milk, and by the time a wet nurse was found, the child was ill with whooping cough and then colitis. It was not until their son had reached a critical condition that Edgar gave a reading. Although no transcript of this reading is in existence, it apparently held out no hope for a recovery. Milton Porter's death certificate states that he died on May 17th, 1 month and 20 days after his birth. The impact on the Casey family could not have been greater. Edgar naturally blamed himself for not giving a reading sooner. Gertrude felt that she hadn't taken proper care of the child, and that Edgar had been too busy with reporters to address the family's needs at home. Distraught, she stopped eating and spent much of each day in bed. Eventually, her health gave way. In late July, Gertrude was diagnosed with tuberculosis, which she had contracted from nursing her brother Hugh on a trip to Texas with her mother. Edgar did not hesitate before volunteering psychic help. But Gertrude didn't want a reading. In fact, she had been the only person in the immediate family who was opposed to ever having one. It wasn't that she didn't believe Edgar could use his psychic powers to help her, for this had been proven to her in the case of her nephew Tommy. But Gertrude still didn't like the business of his giving readings, and didn't want their lives to revolve around them. Well-meaning but uninformed friends had also told her that Edgar would eventually become insane if he continued giving readings. And there were always suspicious people around Edgar with various get-rich-quick schemes, including, in her opinion, Ketchum and Noe. Her steadfast refusal to have a reading was her way of asserting what little control she did have over the situation. Edgar wasn't about to sit back and see Gertrude die like Milton Porter had. He prevailed upon her to put her concerns out of her mind and to have faith in the greater blessings that could come through the work if only she could give herself over to it. Gertrude finally agreed to try. In Edgar's mind, it was the most important reading that he would ever attempt, and he wanted it to be the best. None of his previous readings were more detailed and thorough. For 45 minutes, Casey detailed the condition of virtually all of Gertrude's major body organs and nervous system. He outlined treatments that included osteopathic adjustments for her back, inhalation of spirits to relieve the congestion in her lungs, powerful drugs to help cleanse the blood and various organs, and a diet high in iron supplements and raw vegetables. When Casey woke up, the doctors he had assembled for the reading were pacing up and down the room, shaking their heads. A specialist from Louisville called Casey's diagnosis excellent. His concern was the strange and unusual treatments. From the specialist's perspective, the osteopathic adjustments were not harmful, nor were the laxatives. It was the unusual treatment to clean out the lungs that alarmed him. This treatment consisted of inhaling the fumes of apple brandy from a charred oak keg. Then there were the drugs. Casey had recommended that she take a combination of heroin, eucalyptol, terrabine, and creosote, which were to be mixed into a liquid and placed in a pellet or capsule made from crystallized phosphates of soda. Against the specialist's advice, Edgar declared that he was going to act upon the reading immediately. Gertrude was too weak to resist or care. She could barely raise her head from the pillow. After taking the first capsule, Gertrude stopped hemorrhaging. The fumes of the apple brandy reduced the congestion in her lungs. Within a few days her fever broke, and within 2 weeks she was decidedly on the mend. Although she sometimes had relapses, Gertrude made great strides forward. Gradually she gained strength, and within several months she was back on her feet. While Gertrude came to have a newfound faith in the readings, she grew even more distrustful of Ketchum, especially since Leslie had broken his kneecap and Ketchum had begun conducting the readings. Many times, Ketchum had dispensed with the stenographer altogether. He told Edgar that he took notes and then would dictate his own version of what had been said. Gertrude had begun to suspect Ketchum of either extorting money from various patients or using the readings to personally profit. His suspicions raised, Edgar decided to check up on Ketchum. He wrote a letter to a patient who had allegedly received a reading on one of the days the stenographer had been dismissed. He asked her if the readings had been beneficial to her. The woman said that she had applied for a reading, but had never received one. Edgar confronted Ketchum with the letter. Under pressure, Ketchum admitted taking readings on horse races and other forms of gambling. He referred to it as getting a few tips. As far as Edgar was concerned, the partnership was finished. Ketchum himself must have realized it, for he left town before the partnership was officially disbanded. Edgar never saw him again. As Edgar had done before, and would do again, he turned his back on an unpleasant situation and moved to a city where no one would know him. In January 1912, Edgar literally walked away from the studio, leaving the photo equipment, negatives, and files behind, and moved to Alabama. Leslie, on his own and Edgar's behalf, would later sue Noah and Ketchum for breach of contract and back rents at the studio, totaling some $28,000. The suit was tried before J.T. Hanbury, the same judge who had witnessed a reading when the partnership was being formed and who had later offered to buy Noah and Ketchum's contract with Casey from them. Although his presence as judge in this case was clearly a conflict of interest, he presided over the trial and ruled that the contract as originally drawn up was illegal. The two Caseys were asked to pay legal fees and make a small settlement. In a letter he would later write to a business associate, Edgar described sitting in the courtroom with his father and being overcome with anger by what he believed was a great miscarriage of justice. He also described doing something that he had never done before and which he would sincerely regret later. He wrote that something within him made him rise and address the judge, saying, "For the lie you have this day enacted, the worms of your body will eat you up while you are yet alive." According to Edgar Casey, what he had perhaps willed was indeed what later happened. Hookworms, or some form of intestinal worm infestation, brought on anemia and eventually killed Hanbury. Edgar told his friend, "Possibly it was only a coincidence. Possibly it was playing with fire." Edgar left Hopkinsville, promising himself never to let his anger get the best of him again. Edgar Casey liked to say that he moved to the river city of Selma, Alabama, for the simple reason that it was a good distance from anyone who knew what I did. This may well have been true. However, it was also true that the H.P. Tressler Company, which hired him to open a photography studio in that city in early January 1912, had strategically chosen Selma because it was the fastest-growing city in the state. Upon arrival, Edgar set about preparing a home where he, Gertrude, and Hugh Lynn could be together. He saved his money and dedicated himself to the day, a year and 3 months later, when the family would be reunited. "I can hardly wait until you're strong enough to travel," Edgar wrote home in a postcard when he first arrived. "You'll love it here, and prospects are wonderful." After the demise of the Ketchum partnership, Edgar continued to give readings to patients who sought him out. The reading during this time that had the most lasting impact on his career was given at the request of the Delaney family of Lexington, Kentucky. Amanda Fay Delaney, the wife of the wealthy owner of the Kentucky Lumber Company, had been crippled in an automobile accident and was anxious to have Edgar visit her home. After they had exchanged letters, Edgar agreed to go to Lexington to conduct a reading. Amanda's husband arranged for a physician, along with a stenographer, and another person to conduct the reading. When Edgar arrived and was shown into the living room, Mrs. Delaney was wheeled in on a stretcher to meet him. Her body was so swollen that she could barely move her hands or feet. Doctors described her condition as a severe case of arthritis that was the result of injuries she received nearly a decade before. unable to move because of the pain, she had put on a considerable amount of weight. At only 5'5", she weighed 200 pounds or more. Edgar described her as being in the most pitiful condition of anyone he had ever seen. Although the case seemed hopeless, he was still willing to try. Mr. Delaney declined to conduct the reading himself on the grounds that the Roman Catholic Church forbade the calling up of spirits. He instead had arranged for a Jewish neighbor to conduct the reading, a handsome young college student named Dave Kahn. Edgar handed Dave the small black book, which contained the suggestions that were to be put to him, and instructed him on how to ask the questions at the proper time. In trance, Edgar proceeded to go over Mrs. Delaney's body like a doctor, giving blood pressure, blood count, and other physiological and medical details. He also stated that the family had lived in Fort Thomas, Kentucky, which was where Mrs. Delaney had been in a horse and buggy accident. She had jumped out of the carriage and hit the base of her spine on its step. He said that 6 or 7 years later she had been in an automobile accident, and that this second accident had compounded the original injury. During the course of the reading, the source suggested that an osteopath be called in to treat her, and recommended a physician who had just arrived in Lexington. Casey then proceeded to prescribe several medicines and mixtures. When Edgar awoke, he asked what had been given. "Everything, including the kitchen sink," Mr. Delaney said with obvious delight. "You gave her something for every square inch of her body." Several months later, Edgar returned to Lexington. He was quite moved by what he saw when he arrived. The same woman who had once looked so hopeless was sitting comfortably in a chair. Her feet and lower limbs seemed much better, and her swelling had decreased. 8 or 9 months later, she would invite Edgar to Lexington once again, this time to see her walk across the room at her own birthday party. Later, she was driving her own car. The sessions with the Delaney family, like other readings he gave during his early years in Selma, did much to build Edgar's confidence. But it was important for another reason. Through the Delaneys, Edgar had begun to develop a relationship with 21-year-old Dave Kahn. In the years ahead, it would be Kahn, more than anyone else, who would bring people into the work. Nearly one-third of the readings Edgar would subsequently give can be traced to Kahn or one of his acquaintances. The first reading that Dave conducted was for his brother, Leon, who suffered from epilepsy. The family was greatly impressed by the reading, but they couldn't find anyone who would carry out the treatments prescribed, and Leon died. The mistake the family made with Leon was not repeated when Edgar did a reading for Dave's sister, Eleanor, who became seriously ill with scarlet fever. This time, the family saw to it that the readings were carried out to the letter, and Eleanor recovered. Edgar did many other readings for the Kahn family throughout 1914 and 1915. One interesting reading was aimed at improving the Kahn family grocery business. In a letter to Edgar in Selma, Dave posed the simple question, "How do we improve business?" The subsequent reading might be considered the first of nearly 800 business readings that Casey would do over the next 3 decades. The Kahn family successfully implemented the suggestions contained in the reading and saw their business improve tremendously. The success of this reading prompted Dave to ask another type of question, whether or not he should pursue his father's grocery business as a long-term career. The answer to that question spawned yet another kind of reading, those devoted to career guidance. These readings became known as mental and spiritual readings, and Casey would deliver 400 of these in the ensuing years. Dave Kahn conducted and received the first. In this reading, Casey suggested that there would be a mighty change in the country, and that as conditions developed, Dave Kahn would be forced to leave home. Subsequently, Kahn would find his life's work in an area in which he had not been trained. Furthermore, Casey said, Kahn would also have to leave the flock and go into uniform. It said that he would be in uniform for some time, and that he would go in honor and return in honor. Initially, the reading seemed ridiculous, for none of the Kahns had ever worn a uniform. Dave didn't come from a family that raised policemen or firemen. The family's assumption was that Dave would remain in Lexington and inherit his father's grocery business. Dave Kahn set the reading aside, unable at the time to comprehend that Casey had made the first of many references to the war that would send a generation of American boys to the battlefields of Europe. The years before the declaration of war were some of the happiest in the lives of the entire Casey family. Gertrude and Hugh Lynn had joined Edgar in Selma. With his family at his side, and with Gertrude now firmly in support of his trance readings, Edgar gained a new confidence in his career, both as a photographer and as a psychic. The photography business was doing so well that Edgar was not only able to buy out Tressler's interest in his studio, but he was able to help his father get settled in another Casey studio in nearby Marion, Alabama. Although Leslie remained a poor manager, he did become a competent photographer. It was now Gertrude who was spreading the news of Edgar's readings, and who was his most outspoken defender and champion. She began to share, for the first time, in the wonder and curiosity of his psychic work. She also began to conduct readings. And Edgar, for the first time, was learning how to comfortably juggle his obligations as a father and photographer and his life as a psychic. Although the family was very happy for these years in Alabama, their life was not without its frightening moments. In the spring of 1915, a fire broke out in his studio. As had occurred in the two Bowling Green fires, many precious negatives and personal belongings were lost, and they were forced to temporarily relocate. Meanwhile, as hostilities in Europe began to escalate, it soon became apparent to Dave Kahn that the reading he received indicating that he would go into uniform had not meant a police or fireman's uniform at all, but that of the United States Army. Feeling sure that the military was in his future, he sought and received a commission rather than take his luck with the draft. He obtained what amounted to an honorary commission as a second lieutenant. During the years of the war, Edgar Casey would exchange many letters with Dave Kahn. The most difficult letter that Edgar had to write to him was a letter of condolence. Dave's father, Solomon Kahn, had suddenly died in December of 1918. Although the war had officially ended, Dave was still unable to return to America to attend his father's funeral or to help sort out his father's business affairs. The Kahn grocery business, which had been booming prior to the war, was deep in debt by the time demobilization took place. There were many other letters of condolence that Edgar had to write throughout these years, to console the families of members of his original Bible study and Christian Endeavor classes who had been killed in the war. But Edgar also had the more pleasant task of doing readings for his friends abroad, or their families back home. As his students spread out across Europe, he was given the chance to do readings where the subject was not only hundreds of miles away, but thousands of miles. One of the first readings of this kind was for the wife of the American Consul General, stationed in Italy. Possibly as a result of the growing number of requests in general, and more specifically, the correspondence with the American Consul General in Italy, Edgar received two mysterious summonses to visit Washington, D.C. All Edgar Casey would say about these trips was that they were top secret. In his memoirs, he recalled, "I was called to Washington to give information for one high in authority. This, I am sure, must have been at least interesting, as I was called a year or so later for the same purpose." Exactly who requested these readings, and what prompted the visits, is still a mystery. The most generally accepted theory is that Casey's mail to the Consul General in Italy and to Dave Kahn had been intercepted, and that Casey had been investigated as a result. Reports by the U.S. Department of Military Intelligence, which have never been released until now, confirm that an investigation did indeed take place. Perhaps because of this investigation, Casey was then invited to Washington to give readings on war strategy. Casey himself may never have known who the real recipients of these readings were, because his knowledge of what he said in trance would be told him by the conductor, or other witnesses, only if they chose to tell him. All he may have known about these readings was that he was summoned to Washington, D.C., then guided into a trance. Harmon Brough, one of Casey's biographers, and a one-time secretary to Casey, has claimed that the two readings Casey gave in Washington, D.C. were conducted in late 1917 or early 1918 on behalf of President Woodrow Wilson during his efforts to create the League of Nations. Dave Kahn, in an interview that was conducted 20 years after Edgar's death, also says that Casey gave readings for President Wilson, though he claimed that the readings did not relate to war strategy or the formation of the League of Nations. Rather, they were medical readings conducted when Woodrow Wilson suffered the stroke that paralyzed the left side of his body. Despite the question of whether or not Casey actually conducted readings on the League of Nations for the president, it is clear that he gave hundreds of prophetic and life-saving readings between 1917 and 1920. In a letter to Dave Kahn, Casey described himself as being as busy as a one-legged man in a kicking match. A most unusual reading came soon after the birth of his and Gertrude's third child, Edgar Evans, on February 9, 1918. Nothing unusual happened during the delivery, and the child was a normal, healthy boy. It was Edgar, not Gertrude, who let himself get run down again, losing his voice. Gertrude conducted the standard reading to restore his voice. The session lasted approximately 30 minutes, and turned out to be the first time in which Casey remembered all that transpired while the reading took place. During the reading, Edgar saw the graves of three boys who had been in his Bible class. In front of these graves, there appeared the boys themselves. Each of them told Edgar how they met their death. One had been killed by machine gun fire, another in the bursting of a shell, and the third in heavy artillery fire. Two gave Edgar messages to tell their loved ones at home. Later in the same reading, Edgar saw a friend of the family who was being buried in the local cemetery at the same time that Casey had gone into trance. He had known her well because she had sold him the many flowers that his church class had distributed to hospitals. She said, "Some months ago, someone left $2.50 with you for me. You are not aware of this having been done, and will find it in a drawer of your desk marked with the date it was paid, August 8th. See that my daughter receives this, for she will need it." When Edgar awoke, Gertrude reported to him that he had not said a word during the whole 30 minutes he had been under. Edgar went to look in the drawer for the money that the flower vendor had said would be there. The drawer did indeed contain the money. It had been received on the 8th of August by their studio assistant. Edgar continued to give readings at an ever-increasing pace. The only difference now was that the source began providing information and answering questions that hadn't yet been requested. During one particular session in March, for example, the source diagnosed the condition of 8 different people, in addition to the information that was requested for the individual whose reading had been scheduled that day. The requests for all 8 of these readings were already in the mail, but had not yet reached the Caseys. Also in the mail was a letter from Dave Kahn, saying that he was returning home from France and wanted to meet with Edgar in Lexington to discuss forming a psychic partnership. Kahn had not yet been released from the army, but was on leave until European demobilization was completed. The brash young captain was, as he told Casey, bursting with ideas. This is the end of Side 4. Edgar Casey, an American prophet, continues on the next tape, Side 5.